coming up on Path to Zero.
It seems like a huge problem, and it is a huge problem, but there are fantastic strategies where individuals can make a big difference.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. You know, we created Path to Zero to bring a variety of perspectives about climate change to the table. My goal is always to be open to the ideas our guests bring, even if my view may not square with theirs. In this episode, my guest is Hal Harvey, the chief executive of Energy Innovation, a nonpartisan climate policy firm that advises leaders around the world on how to drive down greenhouse gas emissions. He's an extraordinary thinker who combines big brushstroke ideas with everyday stories of people making a difference in the world today. And even though our viewpoints don't line up perfectly, his expertise cannot be denied. I hope you do like me and allow what he says to inform your own thinking. Another reason you'll want to listen to Hal is that he has just teamed with award-winning New York Times environmental reporter Justin Gillis on a new book, The Big Fix: 7 Practical Steps to Save Our Planet. It's an examination of how communities and individuals can insert themselves into political discussions to raise up climate-conscious choices. It's a pleasure to welcome Hal Harvey to Path to Zero.
It's a real treat. I appreciate the invitation.
We'll spend a lot of time talking today about quite a few things, but let's start with your book, The Big Fix, and it's really been an interesting read for me. Why did you even want to write such a book as The Big Fix?
Well, the climate change problem is enormous, and it has many, many dimensions. Much of it takes place in the long term. And the consequence of that is that it can dissipate people's good energy, just so many factors. So we decided to look at the things that really matter, take a positive view, find out what changes, what specific changes can drive down climate change gases, and do it through stories, individuals, people's stories, so that there's an analytic framework that binds it all together. But really, it's the stories of how individuals can make a serious difference.
And when you and your co-author, Justin, were setting about to write that book, how did you identify those 7 things, those policies that really you think will make the big difference?
So this is my meat and potatoes, understanding which policies make a difference, why, and how to accelerate them. The 2 key words here are speed and scale. The climate change problem is upon us. It's a fixed budget of CO2 emissions we can pump into the air. We've done much more than half of it already. So if we don't have solutions that are fast and broad, we're out of the picture. And that narrows it down to about 7 big ideas.
In your book, you talk a lot about a word that, you know, I guess we really don't talk about enough, and that is generating climate citizens, people who are active. You want to kind of elaborate on what a climate citizen really is to you?
Sure thing. So let me start by contrasting it with a climate consumer. If you try to adjust your buying habits to have less environmental harm, for example, you're a carbon consumer, climate consumer. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's good. But it fails the speed and scale imperative that I mentioned already. So a climate citizen is somebody who uses their voice, their credibility in our political environment to cause large scale changes. And what we've discovered, what I've discovered over years of work in this realm, is it's incredible what a dedicated individual can do if given the proper analytic tools, the proper focus, and comes equipped with some motivation. It seems like a huge problem, and it is a huge problem, but there are fantastic strategies where individuals can make a big difference.
And are these climate consumers usually literally consumers, perhaps just educated people, or do you find them fleet managers or politicians or purchasing managers? Well, do they come from all walks of life and in all socioeconomic scales?
They do. It's, you know, they're the cliche by the recycled paper towels, you know, steps, but your point's actually a really important one. If you run a fleet of trucks for a manufacturing or delivery company, you have the opportunity to, over time, swap out the vehicles in that one for super clean electric vehicles. So there are these force multipliers riddled throughout the economy that people can take advantage of.
I'm going to go back to your book one time, because we've talked about it, the seven practical steps to save our planet, and really told through a series of stories. How about highlighting just a story or two where you found really just to be such a great example of what we should be doing?
Sure thing. So one of the people I've always been impressed with is a Republican woman from Eastern Colorado, which is very much in the plains, a woman named Laura Spratley. She grew up in the days of windmills being used to pump water. There's a lot of wind in the plains and they needed water. Then they needed electricity. And so back in the day, each windmill became a tiny power plant for that farm. She began to see the promise of these bigger and bigger wind turbines. And the ones today, by the way, are almost as big as the Eiffel Tower. They're just huge. And she realized that they could provide a second income to the farmers in her district. She was politically motivated and she became Speaker of the House, again, a conservative Republican. She helped get past a referendum which caused the utilities to invest their mighty sums in the wind turbines. And this was done with the prediction that these investments would drive the prices down. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. So her motivations were social to keep farmers around, financial to make sure there were sufficient incomes, environmental for the obvious reasons. And she took this political issue, this set of opportunities, and drove them into a political victory. And one of the things I like about this is she was so practical, she was so focused, she was able to make a big difference. And that means that the solution didn't fracture along conventional left or right lines, which is really important. We need solutions that bring people together, not drive them apart. And so I won't give a full example, but two of the biggest wind energy states in the country now are Texas and Oklahoma. And they didn't become that way because Al Gore asked them to. They became that way because it was practical, economical, environmentally sound, but it took the pressure of smart, focused people like Laura Spratley to make them happen. That's why the stories are important adjunct to the overall framework.
You know, as I was studying a little bit for this, studying you and kind of some of the things you've worked on, fascinated me that you spent a lot of time in China and really kind of have a pretty broad portfolio of views in India. Let's start with two countries I'm fascinated with, just if for population, nothing else. But China, certainly as we talk today, China still seems to be very committed to coal. Talk to me about what you see is happening in China in terms of their balancing innovation versus a reliable and affordable energy and then the climate.
Well, it's a complicated and fascinating story. The first thing that has to be said about China is most of the people, even up to pretty high levels, are engineering or economical driven and trained people. So I've made many, many trips to China, worked with them on probably over 100 policies now. And it was all technical assistance. We never got into politics. Of course, there are political issues. But to make real progress, you don't start with that. You don't push that. You work on the solutions. The second thing is China has vast reserves of coal. It's a domestic energy source and helps them with their energy security. They have very little oil and natural gas. And so they try to use coal for everything. They have now gotten the bug on wind and solar, and they're deploying those at fantastic rates. They're putting up more windmills per year than the rest of the world has in all of history. So it's now sort of a race between the clean alternatives like wind and solar and the existing alternative, which is coal. And it's absolutely crucial for the whole world that race be won by clean energy technologies. I'm optimistic about China's prospects. They have, as I mentioned before, made enormous commitments to clean energy, and they're doing it successfully. They're also switching to electric vehicles. More than 27% of vehicles sold in China last year were electric vehicles. So if you have a clean grid powering an electric car, you have clean transportation as well. And they're moving heavily into heat pumps, which produce four times as much heat as the electricity required to run them, typically. So put another sense, it requires one quarter of the electricity to run a heat pump compared to an electric resistance heater. This game is not over. And China is building a lot of coal-fired power plants. In my opinion, they're not building them for economic reasons. In fact, their use of coal is more or less flat. So they're building more power plants and running them fewer and fewer hours. That's a bizarre and artificial economics, and they've got to break that. There are a number of very smart Chinese officials who understand that's a bizarre and non-productive sort of policies. But this is an evolving situation.
I'm going to ask you lots of questions about that, but let's just talk also about India, because I know you've advised there and you quite study it. How do you see India moving towards a clean climate?
So India is another fascinating story. I think 1.4 billion people or so in India. There are pockets of prosperity in India, growing middle class, but also a lot of very poor people without access to electricity. You cannot develop unless you have access to electricity. It's simply a requirement. The good and the great news is that photovoltaic panels, PV panels, are now the cheapest source of electricity on planet Earth. They cost 2 or 3 cents per kilowatt hour, and your electricity bill, in contrast, is probably between 12 and 15 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, those are not directly comparable prices because your electricity bill is covering the whole system expenses, whereas a PV panel is just a panel. But still, it now means that electricity is affordable for essentially everybody in India. The other thing about photovoltaics, these PV panels, is you can build a tiny grid, a microgrid that supports 10 or 20 houses or one house if you want. So you don't need copper transmission lines all over the country. And since India doesn't have those copper transmission lines all over the country, PVs offer them a huge new alternative. The analogy that's often made is cell phones versus landlines. So in America, we had landlines for decades, and then we got cell phones. Kids in America today don't have landlines. India doesn't need landlines. It can skip all that expense and all that development just by using mobile phones. And so the analogy is, why go through the dirty stages of energy development instead of leapfrogging directly to the clean stages and save a lot of money at the same time?
Yeah, one of the things that always strikes me is, at least in America, we're trying to do something completely different in this energy transformation with the old systems. I mean, I think it's going to be really difficult to do something radically different tied to that old infrastructure. And I know I watched a couple of your talks and completely agree. We have this opportunity in a lot of places that are developing to do something outrageously different from the beginning. Decentralized grids, perhaps no grid at all, right? Almost consumer-sized power stations, if you think about some of the African communities, for sure.
And it might make sense in the foothills of California where the falling power lines start fires. So let's be smart about where we apply it. It's not a one size fits all, but there are some terrific opportunities with distributed power.
Yeah, we're certainly seeing some microgrid action there as well. You know, when you talk a lot about the grid and where we need to go to a green grid, and I really tend to think that you believe that ultimately the grid will be 100% free of carbon. Is that kind of your view, right?
Well, I'm happy to get to 90 and leave some for the next generation to mop up. But yes, I mean, the shorthand I sometimes use is clean up the grid and then electrify everything. But actually, you want to do them at the same time. It's not a Pollyanna-ish perspective. It's underway in a lot of industrialized countries right now, well underway. The question that everybody raises is, what about a cold 2 weeks in North Dakota when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing? And we can dig into that a little bit if you're interested. There are fantastic solutions to those problems, and they're not always the intuitive ones.
Yeah, no, I'd love you to dig into those, because And I agree, it's not so much about 2 weeks as it is perhaps this 8 hours or that time, certainly intermittent periods. But yeah, talk about that, because I think that's something we don't talk about enough.
So there's a portfolio of options, and one needs to use almost all or sometimes all of the portfolio of options. The first thing to do is to commit to 100% reliability, period. Yield a backseat to no one in that commitment. The second thing to do is to look across your generation and consumption worlds and try to find opportunities to dispatch them intermittently so that you can match supply with demand. So for example, there are some industrial processes that you want to run on the sunniest, hottest day because electricity is cheap, that you don't want to run on the coldest morning in December. And that's called demand response. And a big industry can do it, but you'd be amazed at you know, these Nest thermostats that Google sells. They can reduce your heating or your cooling by 1 or 2 degrees across a million households and restabilize the grid. So there's your speed and scale offering. So managing the demand side alongside the supply side is important. And then there are renewable energy sources that are dispatchable, like hydro, biomass, and geothermal. They're just like a thermal power plant. You can turn them on and off up to a point. You can adjust the price to discourage excessive consumption during scarce hours and adjust it the other way, make it cheaper when there's surplus energy. There are electricity storage ideas. There are better and better batteries. They're being deployed more and more often. There are thermal storage strategies. You can preheat or pre-cool buildings, for example, so that you don't put load on in the worst moments. You can move electricity across large geographies. So San Diego and Seattle never have the same peak demand or the same peak supply. Hook them together with some copper and they smooth each other out. They offset each other's problems. It's fantastic. And in fact, the copper wires are there, but the regulatory apparatus is not encouraging enough movement of electricity from one part of the grid to the other part of the grid.
That was what I was thinking about. The technology may be there, but boy, the regulatory apparatus, as you say, moving between those various balancing authorities, yes. quite political, I think.
It is, and it's political for silly reasons. It's parochial politicization. It's not system optimization. You know, the Bonneville Power Administration, which controls all the dams in the Pacific Northwest, sells bulk power super cheap to Bonneville customers. And the Bonneville customers don't want them selling power to California because they think it's their electricity. Of course, it's not. It's federal electricity. But if you think of comparative advantage, which is how we run the rest of our economy, they should sell it to California when the prices are high and use it for themselves when the prices are low. Both California and Seattle, or California and Washington, would benefit from that. So we need to move into a realm where we make more economically informed decisions and take advantage of a wider array of technological ways to stabilize the grid. But it all comes back to the first point: never compromise the security and the reliability of the grid. Just use more tools to manage the grid.
Yes.
And by the way, the last point is important too. If I run a natural gas power plant for 100 hours a year for those peak moments when I need it, that's just fine. It's a trivial amount of carbon compared to running them 24/7.
Hal Harvey, what a wonderful discussion so far. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll be right back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. Our guest is Hal Harvey, the founder of Energy Innovation, and we're talking about decarbonization and energy policy.
I've studied you a bit and I haven't heard you talk much about nuclear. What do you think we need to do with nuclear I'll start with this country, but then I might add with the world.
Yeah. So people argue about nuclear power. They fall in love with it or they hate it. And I don't think those are the right approaches. I think instead you want to look at the attributes of nuclear power both today and tomorrow. So let me give you my quick analysis. There are about 400 operating nuclear power plants in the world. They're almost all so-called Generation 2 or Gen 2 reactors. They were mostly built in the 70s and 80s, and they're aging out. They're bombarded 24/7 with radioactivity, which makes them brittle. And you can only run them for so long. They become uneconomical and they become unsafe if you run them more than 40 or 50 years. So that those 400 power plants are scheduled to be shut down or will be scheduled to be shut down in the coming one or two decades. So we're going to lose that source of clean energy. Generation 3 was supposed to be the next brand. They're safer, they're bigger, but they're much more complex and they are hideously expensive. There are two of them being built in Europe and they're coming in at almost 10 times the price of wind or solar. So they're not going to spread because they're so expensive. And then there's the future reactors, so-called Gen 4. And there are about half a dozen interesting design ideas for Gen 4 reactors. But for reactors to succeed, in my opinion, they have to be reliable, safe, cost-effective, low carbon, proliferation resistant, and affordable. And let me just spend a second on the proliferation resistant question. If you refine petroleum products the high degrees you need for some of these models, a high degree of radioactivity, you're also creating bomb-ready material. And the proliferation of nuclear weapons, as Vladimir Putin is reminding us, is one of the most frightening security dangers in the world, maybe the most frightening. So if we build a new power system based on technology which can be converted to bombs, we better hope we're really lucky. I don't think it's a smart way to plan. So what I would do is challenge the proponents of Gen 4 nuclear reactors to continue to refine their design ideas, but to deal with all of those problems, affordability, reliability, safety, proliferation. And if they skip one of them, not good enough.
It just seems like, though, without nuclear power, in a world as you keep envisioning it, that would have more electric vehicles, more electric appliances like heat pumps. Yeah. Our society continues to evolve and grow and demand more and more power, that the reliance on truly renewable grid, true zero carbon grid, it doesn't even seem feasible to me as I look at the math of gigawatts demand, gigawatts supplied. But you seem to believe that can all happen.
Well, we're building a lot more renewables, 20 times as much as we are nuclear, at least worldwide. So both speed and scale are arguing for renewables right now. But again, just as I say don't fall in love with nuclear, don't hate nuclear, don't fall in love with wind or solar, don't hate wind or solar. Every energy source has both positive and negative attributes. And you need to build a portfolio that aren't going to get the job done. I wish nuclear didn't have these problems. I wish the old ones could run forever. I wish the new ones didn't threaten national security, but they do.
Yeah.
So we have.
And to your point about speed and scale, I don't think we should best wait for fusion. I think that will be another day.
Yeah, there's this old line: fusion is the power source of the future. And it always will be.
Always will be. So lastly, again, studying you, I hear beautiful ideas, but rarely do you talk about cost, either the investments required or the cost of the final product. And I sit thinking about you living just north of San Francisco, probably today paying, I don't know, somewhere in excess of 40 cents a kilowatt hour, perhaps, I don't know, for your publicly produced power. I mean, you certainly live in, I guess, the second highest electric price in the country, Hawaii being taking the lead there. Where do we get the money to transform this grid? And how do consumers, sacrifice that money to get to where we need to get?
So the big important secret on economics is, for many, but not all technologies, the more you build of them, the cheaper they get, so-called cost curves. And we devote a chapter in the book to cost curves, and we use it as a thread all the way through. So solar is down 90% in price in the last 12 years. Wind is down almost 50%. Offshore wind is down 40%. LEDs are down 99%. And so if you have technologies that do the job and are becoming cheaper, you can see, begin to see the pathway. If you unpack California's electricity bills, you'll see that most of it goes for sunk cost, to pay off sunk costs with decisions that were made long ago with grid, with big power plants, and with nuclear power. The money that's going into renewables today saves money for consumers. It's 2 cents a kilowatt hour at the wholesale is the cheapest form of electricity on planet Earth. It's new PV. So what's happening is that the utility transformations are exceeding the demands of the public in speed and scale. American Electric Power used to be the biggest coal burning utility in the country, and it's now phasing out all of its coal. And they're doing it because it saves their customers money. So I would not soften the demands for affordability. I would insist on them. The dispatch of the grid should be based on economics. The economics should include pollution costs, if it's feasible to do so. It is now. But even without including them, clean energy is the cheapest. Mm-hmm. So I would vigorously resist the idea that we don't care about costs. It's quite the opposite. And if you look
at I don't mean to imply that you didn't care about it. I know you hadn't talked about it. I know I kept looking in your history to see how much you'd been involved with finance, because I knew as much as you're advising governments, you have to be thinking about, you know, the cost of finance and the cost of the finished products.
Yeah. I mean, the jurisdiction in the world with the strongest environmental laws is the state of California. And the state of California is also one of the most economically successful jurisdictions in the world. If you look at the Nordic countries or Germany, you find similar outcomes. That correlation is an insufficient, it doesn't imply causation, but it demonstrates absolutely that you can have clean prosperity. And that's what we need.
But it is interesting, as in it, again, you talk about California being leading. I think about Germany. Both of those are places that exhibited really high electric costs and has driven manufacturing to another. They've had to go away. Manufacturing has to go to where their raw material costs are high, are low, their manufacturing costs are low. And I wonder over time if Germany or California will be able to be competitive at those high electric rates.
So two things there. One is if an electric car uses far less energy, has far lower energy cost than a gasoline car, because you don't have the conversion losses in electric of an internal combustion engine. And California is now home to the largest exporting car company in America, which is Tesla. So there are many opportunities still in that realm. The other thing that's important, though, is we compare electricity rates, how much per kilowatt hour does electricity cost in different jurisdictions. We should be comparing electricity bills. So if you build a super efficient house, and California has the strictest building code in America by far, your electric bills are going to be very low, even though your electric rates are high. So it's an opportunity to use energy efficiency as the weapon, if you will, yeah, or a strategy.
Well said. All right, let me talk about one other thing and then we'll start wrapping up. But I want to hear your views on green hydrogen, because I know you've been a strong, you know, proponent of green hydrogen. You talk glowingly about it as part of the future. But again, so talk to us, because I think, again, for me, green hydrogen, I think about it. Clearly, we all wish for it. But two things always prevent me from getting excited about it. A, the finished cost. And then B, something no one else ever talks about, which is the water demands. And I think today we talk about energy, land use, but one day we're going to talk about water use and water rights in that same vein, I think. So talk to me about why you're so positive on green hydrogen in view of cost and water demand.
So first of all, I I think the opportunities for green hydrogen are severely limited. There are some instances where it offers great potential, but for bulk power or bulk mobility, not at all. I mean, if you go through the thermodynamics of turning electricity into hydrogen and water and then burning that hydrogen through a fuel cell or an internal combustion engine, you end up with single digit efficiencies. There are certain realms where we will need hydrogen. We may need it to synthesize synthetic liquid fuels for aviation. We may need it for chemical processes. We will need it for chemical processes. We already use a lot of hydrogen for chemical processes. So we may as well get more and more of that hydrogen from electrolysis, splitting the hydrogen atoms off from the oxygen atoms. So I think it's going to be useful for 5 to 10% of our energy economy. I think it will be more expensive, although it's, electrolyzers have their own cost curve. They're getting cheaper. Fuel cells are getting cheaper. It'll be used as a factor input for chemicals and for certain areas where you need liquid fuels. Mm-hmm. You're going to need liquid fuels for airplanes. It's just a matter of fact. It's a thermodynamic necessity, in my opinion. There is a I love hydrogen atmosphere out there. I'm not part of that, but maybe for steelmaking, although there's some electrification of steelmaking opportunities that are profound. For niche markets where you need the characteristics of hydrogen, great. For the big winner is going to be electrification. There's so much more in industrial processes we can do with electrification that's barely studied.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward. I mean, I know we're investing about $8 billion in these hydrogen hubs today.
Yeah.
Bright people working on it. So I'm curious to see what they'll get to. But I love hearing your views on that. Okay, let's have a little fun. We love to use magic. It works for many, so we're going to try to have it work for us. We're going to hand you a magic wand, and you get to use it to change one thing in the next year that has the biggest impact regarding climate change. How would you use that wand?
Well, I would use it to cause China's coal consumption to go down on a rapid and firm schedule over the next 15 years. This is the single greatest source of pollution, climate pollution in the world. The technology is there to replace it. China's got very serious climate change commitments, but they need to accelerate them by a lot.
That's a great use of your wand, and thank you. Let's have one other bit of fun. One of the ways we love to thank our guests for being here is we plant a tree in your honor in a national forest. The fun part is for that you pick the forest and we do all the rest of the work. And you're a Californian, so I know you have lots of great national forests there. But anywhere specifically you'd love us to plant a tree?
I'm going to go back to my Colorado heritage, which is where I'm from, and it would have to be the White River National Forest in Colorado. And I'll tell a quick anecdote about that, which. My mother was a staunch conservationist, environmental leader, and she and two friends, both women, hiked every valley, most mountains surrounding the Aspen area, where she moved in the 50s, and wrote citizens' wilderness proposals, four of them over a course of 40 years, and submitted them to Congress, and caused half a million acres to be declared pure wilderness by Congress. It took 40 years, took a lot of hiking, a lot of biological assessments and so forth. But it's proved that these three women helped save a vast amount of some of the most beautiful land in America.
Unbelievable. That's a great story. Congratulations for that.
No, it's something to try to live up to.
A lot to be proud of. Well, we will look forward to planting a tree there in your honor. All right, before we wrap up, anything else we haven't talked about? You want to tell our listeners about the big fix? Maybe something that's coming up you'd like them to know?
Yeah, I would say the following. Individuals can have a huge outsized impact on climate change if they pick one area where they can make a policy difference. And it's amazing the areas, and this is covered in the book, that are susceptible to quiet intervention by smart, dedicated citizens. Does your school have electric buses, or do the kids breathe the exhaust from dirty diesels? That's a political choice that your school board can make. Is your utility adding renewable energy and decreasing fossil energy every year under a structured, verified plan. That's another place. Those are open forums that individual citizens with a couple days study, some alliances between them, can help influence. So don't let the size of the problem deter you at all. Instead, dig into the dynamics of energy choices, choose one, and get in there and make a difference. And that's what the book unpacks for us. It's a force multiplier is what it should be.
Well, I think it's great advice. And I think as we travel and speak and talk about this as well, it is amazing how complex it is. And I think it does, one, most people aren't that interested in it. They're interested in something else, but it's so complex. I think it prohibits a lot of people from entering the conversation. So I think it's a great use of their time and great advice. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Tucker. It's really wonderful to have this conversation with you.
Hal, it's been a great time with you, and thanks for being our guest today on Path to Zero.
My pleasure.
Well, that'll do it for another episode of Path to Zero. And don't forget, we'd like to hear from you on guest suggestions or questions and comments. Send us an email at path2zero@propane.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.